You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rabbi Scott Glass. Scott, it's good to have you here this morning.
Thank you, Eric. It's good to be here.
So the way this show starts is with a big question. Who are you? What do we need to know about you to start this conversation?
Well, I don't know that you need to know anything about me, but...
Well, if we have a picture of your life...
Yes.
And this show is about appreciating the lives of the people of this area.
Well, I obviously thought about the question some, and I decided that the best answer would be to say I'm an exceedingly fortunate individual who is not nearly as grateful for my good fortune as I should be.
I'm sorry, but there's a traditional kind of Jewish guilt piece, kind of.
No, there's no, no, I don't feel guilty about it. Okay. I think, you know, in thinking about it, I acknowledge it.
It's just a fact.
It is just a fact. And I mean, I know the people who know me well, and you know me well enough to know that I can complain with the best of them. But in thinking about the question, I realized I was really a very lucky person. And, I grew up in a household of hardworking people who really cared about one another. I was very fortunate. I grew up with my grandparents and my parents in the house. And,
wow.
At some times of the year, we were four generations in the house from both sides of the family at the same time.
Wow.
It was really pretty amazing. Wow. And I grew up surrounded by family, and that was wonderful. It was a really great gift. And, I met and married an extraordinary woman, and who has been an enormous support to me, and has been there straight through the most important parts of my life. I have terrific kids, to be able to, and I had the great good fortune of. And pleasure of watching my grandchildren interact with my parents on a very active level, and watching that was just such an enormous gift. And then I ended up here in Ithaca, which was, I'm here over 40 years, and in the clergy, that's not necessarily the norm, certainly not in the rabbinate.
Right.
And I don't think I could have ever imagined how lucky I would be to find myself in a city like Ithaca, in a congregation like Temple Bethel. I've just been really, really lucky on all those counts.
Mm-hmm. And we can, it is unusual now. It may not have been so unusual years ago.
Right.
Among certain Protestants, it wasn't unusual at all years ago. It's not, and it could be an enormous blessing. It could be an enormous weight, you know. So you brought some music with you.
I did.
What are we going to open with here?
So the first piece, and... you and I have had a back and forth on this piece. The first piece is by a composer named Louis Lewandowski. And he, from the 19th century, he wrote some really very beautiful synagogue music. And this piece was one of the first choral pieces that really spoke to me on a very personal level. I started hearing this piece in synagogue on the high holidays, probably from the time I was about 10 or 11 years old. And it always spoke to my heart. It's majestic and it's his setting for Psalm 150.
And do you want to remind us of the opening line of that song?
Hallelujah, right?
Yeah.
And then it mentions all of the different instruments that are used, and then it ends with the phrase, Kol haneshamata hallelujah, hallelujah. All that breathes should praise God. Hallelujah.
Yes, yes, yes. Here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Rabbi Scott Glass. So, Scott, given the life that you have come to value, and you are retiring now, so this is an inflection point for you. Given the life that you have come to value, what did you have to learn to know how to live it?
Many years ago, I passed a friend in the hall at what was then Tompkins County Hospital, and he said to me, "Can't you do something about this weather?" And at the time, I was talking to a much beloved physician, Noah Kassman, who was an obstetrician gynecologist. And he turned to the other person and he said, "Don't you know he's in sales, not management?" And so that's one of the things I think I had to learn, that there were certain things that were just not in my control. And you can't control everything. And sometimes you have to figure out how to react in sensible, reasonable ways. So that's one of the things. I mean, I came here, I was very young, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and I had to do a lot of growing up. when the congregation met to vote on my candidacy, there was a Q&A, and an older member of the congregation asked me about what I was going to do, how I saw my role in interfaith relations. And because of experiences that I had had interviewing with other congregations, I had said to him, well, I'm coming to Ithaca to be the rabbi of the Jewish community, not the Gentile community. That didn't go over really big. I had no idea how stupid I was when I said it.
Right.
Or what an important role the rest of the community would have in my life. So there are all these things that you learn along the way. As you well know, you know, school doesn't train you for whatever it is that you're going to do in this life.
Right.
You know.
Right. Regardless of the school or the
or the profession, right?
Yeah.
So I think.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, what were the being in an interfaith, being in a community where you are the face of Judaism when you arrived, but now it is sufficiently diverse. I would imagine then it was diverse too.
It's always been diverse, and I think just because. Then there was only one congregation, but the truth of the matter is the community was as divided as every other community is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's never easy to be the representative of a particular community. But right. The fact of the matter is, what most of us don't realize is that throughout our lives, most of the time, we're not just representing ourselves.
Right.
We're out there, and people see us as representing whoever it is that they think we're representing.
And right. And whatever they're projecting or whatever they're taking
right.
away from
exactly.
us.
Exactly. So, you know, I there have been times when I think I let that go to my head a little bit. You know, like it was too... it was like I was too proud of that fact, you know. And then there are other times when I was just as happy, you know, like, don't look at me like that.
You've got Temple Beth-El and that's enough.
well, there's that. But also, you know, so the other night there was this gathering at the library, this combating climate of hatred. And I spoke about anti-Semitism. And the first thing I said was the opinions that I'm expressing are mine alone.
Right.
Because my community is a diverse community. It's not monolithic. And I wanted people to know that this was what I thought. This is what I believed in, not, you know, I wasn't representing anybody else.
Right, right. It's not a doctrine or teaching.
Right.
So as you, I what for me was you know, for me the challenge hasn't been, I'm going to put this in slightly more punchy language. I've known most of my life that I'm not God, but at times, I haven't known how to advocate for whatever else it is in the most effective manner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily to control it, but to just engage it, because that's partly where I live and the work that I do. How did you come to terms? How did you discover that management wasn't your role?
Oh gosh. Well, I think part of it is realizing how much happens to us that's not in our control. I've had the misfortune. I mean, I talked about how fortunate I was. I didn't talk about my misfortune.
I figured it was coming around on the guitar.
Which is, well, I mean, you know, I've had a lot of health issues over the years, and my good fortune is that I've had a lot of good doctors, and I'm very grateful to the medical professionals, the doctors and nurses who've cared for me over the years. But it's humbling.
Right.
I mean, you learn very quickly that, you know, you are merely a vessel. And
a broken vessel at that, on some profound level.
That's true. Yeah. And you know, I think it's it makes one realize not only how little control we have, but also how hard we have to work to make our lives meaningful and make it work. You know,
what does that mean? How little control we have and how hard we have to work to make our lives meaningful.
Well, you have to put forth effort. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
You want to find ways to reach people, to do things that are significant, to make contributions to the world that you think are mm-hmm. worthwhile and important. And I've tried to do that. Mm-hmm. I think I have to say, when I said how, you know, fortunate I am that I've ended up here in Ithaca and right. Temple Bethel, you know, I've thought often that there were so many opportunities that came my way that I would have never had I been the rabbi in a larger city, right. a large metropolitan area.
What were some of them?
Well, I mean, some of them come as a result of, you know, people who come here to Ithaca to do things, but also, you know, I would have never taught, I would have never given lectures at Cornell or mm-hmm. Ithaca College. I would have never taught at Cortland State or the like, mm-hmm. probably, you know, but also, for example, one thing that you're very familiar with was this concert that we did in 2010 or 2011, in the aftermath of the Sean Greenwood, incident and the Healing Ithaca effort that the clergy engaged with the leadership of Leslie Meyerhoff. I mean, to be able to organize a concert for the community, and you and I had differences about this concert,
yeah, yeah.
But for me, I felt like this was an opportunity to bring the community together in a setting that, you know, could show people that different people could work together and create something beautiful. And I have to say, you are in part the impetus for the concert that followed, because you had made a comment about, you know, people singing their own music or something, and I thought about it. And so 2 years later, we did another concert. We arranged another concert, which was many diverse groups performing and interacting with one another at the State Theater. I don't think I could have ever done that in a larger community,
right.
You know, in a different place. And I still believe that those concerts were important contributions to the community.
Yeah. I'll come back to the concerts and we'll play mm-hmm. some music, I think, but shortly from one. But what I want to note is that when I ask you about being humbled and then having to work harder, it's like you don't necessarily get the opportunity to do what your first intention was because that kind of got humbled. But then you work harder to find something that actually will fit or work or no.
That's sometimes true. I think for me it was just, you know, the realization that if I want to make a contribution, I better make a contribution.
Right. It's not a cakewalk.
Right. And, you know, I may not have 50 years to, you know, do it now.
And another piece that comes with humbling, how did it affect your capacity to trust? Or did it? And was there any relationship?
No, I think if anything, it forced me to trust more. I mean,
that's what I was about anticipating.
Okay. I mean, I put my life in the hands of people. I mean, I can't tell you. And I mean, there are so many different stories and I'm not going to go into all these stories, yes. but the fact of the matter is, on the one hand, there's very little in the way of privacy and modesty when you're really ill, but you become dependent on a lot of different people for a lot of different things, and you do have to trust that they're going to do the best for you. And in it was my good fortune that they did.
Mm-hmm. Or that you can ask for something different, or that you can engage right. even in a position of weakness.
Right.
I used to have a kind of a rule that I wouldn't let people be in helping roles in the congregation unless they had asked for help, because they hadn't learned how to trust.
Oh.
And so that's kind of partly why, and your response by becoming more, having to be more trusting is the typical response. And it's very powerful, even if, I mean, especially when we have positions of relative power or people perceive we have power. Yeah.
Right.
So let's go to the music from that first concert.
Okay.
What do you want?
So this is, a setting for Psalm 121. It was originally written by Shlomo Carlebach. It's performed by Neshama Carlebach, his daughter, and the Green Pastures Baptist Church Choir. Their performance together, actually, the first time they performed together, I happened to be there. It was a complete accident. They were brought together by Rabbi Avi Weiss, who is the rabbi of the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. And he thought it would be a great idea. The Baptist Church Choir, Green Pastures Baptist Church Choir, always performed at Hebrew Institute of Riverdale on Martin Luther King's birthday. And the leader of the Baptist Church Choir loved the music of Shlomo Carlebach. And so... Rabbi Weiss thought, why don't we bring the two together? And they performed beautifully, and this is their arrangement of Essa Einai, I Will Lift My Eyes to the Mountains.
Oh,
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. This is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest is Rabbi Scott Glass. So, Scott, tell me about that psalm.
So there are a couple of things. First of all, about the psalm itself. The psalm is very, very significant for me. I draw a lot of strength from it and inspiration from it. I actually use it at every funeral that I do. Wow. It really centers me somehow. But I also, the melody, not all of the
orchestration
and elaboration and everything, but the original melody for the piece, I learned when I was like 8 years old. I don't think at that point I even knew who Shlomo Carlbach was or anything else, but I knew, I learned Essa Einai, the Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And to hear it performed this way was just like mind blowing. I think very beautiful.
Where does it live in you? Mm. Where does this song live in you?
Well, if I wanted to give a Jewish answer, I'd say in my kishkas, in my innards.
Yes. Your gut.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, I think in a lot of ways, it's very much a part of me because it's so deeply ingrained in me from a very, very early age. And when I really registered what the psalm was saying, it became that much more significant. Right.
This is almost the same as having the scripture written on our hearts.
Yeah. Right. Very good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the, because I understand. I understand. How, you know, you've talked about this in some ways, but how has life surprised you? How has things turned out in ways that you would not have anticipated and not necessarily wanted to choose?
How has life surprised me? Well, certainly staying in Ithaca as long as I have. We came here with the expectation that we would be here for 2, maybe 3 years, and then we were going to leave. Mm-hmm.
What happened? Another child.
No. It wasn't a child. Yeah. No, it was actually, so that it was twofold. One was the congregation really wanted me, and that was a very, very good feeling.
Right.
And the other was that just after I signed my second contract, I was deathly ill. And they could have very easily said, look, you know, you're a nice guy and everything, but we don't want to be spending our time nursing our rabbi, you know? And instead, the person who was then I think he was the chairman of the board or maybe the president of the congregation, came to my house, called one day and said, could I come over? Came over with a manila envelope filled with money and said, I'm bringing you this. This is from many members of the congregation for you to do with it what you need to. This had nothing to do with salary or anything else. I didn't know what to do. I gave him back the money. That I did. I said, you know, we're fortunate. Our families can help us if we need it. We don't need it right now. And I really appreciate it. How do you leave after that?
Yeah.
You know, so that was a very big thing. And then there have been a number of other times during the course of the many years that I've been here where other opportunities have come up or whatever. And the community has been so amazingly understanding. You know, you need to do what's right for you and for your family, and we will understand. And I actually did interview someplace else a number of years ago, which in many ways would have been an ideal community for my family, at many benefits. And
at the age they were at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I met up with my oldest friend. He took me to the airport so that I could fly back. And he said to me, asked me a lot of questions. And when we were all done, he said, you know, Scott, you haven't said one positive thing about anybody in this whole conversation. Are you really sure you want to make this move? And I thought about it and thought about it, and I realized he was right. There were lots of unimportant things that I liked, but I had no connection with the people. There was no rapport. And I just said, you know, this is silly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, yeah. And I mean, it's really neat when our friends can kind of reflect back to us what we're saying, but we're not processing
right.
that we're saying.
True.
Have you been in these years here? Have you been kind of, I don't know how to put this, put in a position where you've really had to change one of your deeply held commitments or been forced into an understanding that you really had fought?
No, I think that any of the convictions that I have held, I've held on to.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And for better or for worse, I think that there are people in the community who would have liked me to compromise on certain things or other, but
I asked it in the most blunt way. But how have you had to change your understanding in order to move yourself forward?
Well, I think, you know, as one gets older, one realizes that there are ways that one can adjust or compromise and move on certain issues. You figure it out over the course of time. I don't know.
You're the spiritual religious leader in an extremely diverse Jewish environment. Yeah. I mean, by some counts, we would put the population of people with Jewish identifications of varying sorts to 10 to 15%, which is way high compared to who belong mm-hmm. to any of the congregations.
Right.
How do you hold your own in that environment and not hold too much? I mean, you did this in terms of how you introduced your talk at the combating
racism.
Or hatred.
Yeah, you know, some of it is just I'm old enough now that I just don't care.
Don't react.
It's like, what are you going to do?
Right. Right.
This is who I am. This is what I believe. This is how.
And this is who you are. This is who these others
right.
are. This is who what the community is.
And you know, there are times that there have been conflicts. On the basis of that, you know, people who are just not happy with the way I do things or what I believe or how I feel or what they perceive as my forcing on the congregation.
Is there one of those that you would be comfortable talking about? And I mean this, and then this is not a hostile conversation at all.
I know.
It's a curious conversation.
I don't think anybody in the Jewish community would be surprised if I said intermarriage.
Mm-hmm.
The issue of intermarriage is a difficult one. And while I feel I've made a number of very significant changes in the way our congregation operates and things that we do, there are still people who don't feel that I've done enough or who don't agree with
your stance on intermarriage.
Right. Right. And so
I come from the Protestant denomination with the highest rate of intermarriage in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
And there are issues with that. There mm-hmm. are serious issues around identity. What brought you to the position that you have on intermarriage?
I don't know that I have a
comprehensive answer. Yeah, just
look, I'll put it to you this way, Eric.
Yeah.
I have a very varied background. I went to an Orthodox Jewish day school from kindergarten through 12th grade. My family belonged to a conservative synagogue, and I went to Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion, which is a reform institution.
So I've got
a lot behind me.
Except the Reconstructionists.
Right. And so because I went to Hebrew Union College, after you're ordained, you automatically are welcomed into the Central Conference of American Rabbis, the Organization of Reform Rabbis. And just at the time when I was coming out of school, the whole question of patrilineal descent, like who is a Jew,
right.
and how you determine who a Jew is, and all of many issues concerning intermarriage, were really being debated very heavily. And it was then that I realized that although I have remained a member of the CCAR, I knew that I needed to officially become a conservative rabbi and join the rabbinical assembly, because the positions that the CCAR were taking just did not jive with where my head was at. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like I made a very... it was a very serious personal decision that was out of conviction, and I continue to hold that conviction, and so that's who I am, and that's what I believe. So, you know, there are certain things that I just can't accept.
And intermarriage is one of them, and it is, and I get the sense that it lives in your gut in a similar way.
Well, so just to clarify,
sure,
because just saying intermarriage is one of them, that's not entirely, you know, that doesn't cover the whole story, and so we have a large number of, I mean, I think people would be surprised to know what percentage of our membership is our intermarried families, who are completely accepted in the congregation and involved in the community. And there are certain adjustments that we make along the way. For example, we have now designated a certain part of our cemetery for intermarried couples.
So they can be buried together.
So, I mean, there are things that we've done and choices that we've made and understandings that we have. However, you know, I'm not going to officiate an intermarriage.
Right.
And there are certain roles within the life of the congregation that I don't believe can be properly performed by somebody who's not Jewish.
Who's not Jewish, yeah.
Basically, that's
right.
And
what I want you to hear from me is I appreciate the discomfort that I may have put you in by asking more about that. But what you have given us is an understanding of how you work with people as they are and with yourself as you are. Because you're not going to do the intermarriage, but you're not going to condemn the people who come into your door to be part of a beloved community.
Exactly.
And you're going to find places, but it's not just going to be any place, because it has to fit, but it also has to fit everybody's sense. And you're the rabbi. And there are many people who have a stake in how that community is.
That's right.
We live in a world where we don't know each other well enough to appreciate the specifics of the dilemmas and the workarounds that we're doing every day.
I think that's true.
And I thank you for sharing one of them on the show, because I think it helps us to appreciate the complexity of our lives.
Okay, I'm glad I could help.
I want to take a digression into music, and I'm wondering, would this be a good time to play CJ's piece?
I would be happy to have you play CJ's piece.
Now, do you want to tell the story of the piece before we play it, or or some of both?
Why don't I just say that this is a recording of my son CJ performing on The Voice in Israel.
When the rain is blowing in your face and the whole world is on your case, I could offer you a warm embrace to make you feel my love. When evening shadows and the stars appear, and there is no one there to dry your tears, I could hold you for a million years to make you feel my love. I know you haven't made your mind up yet. Could make you happy, make your dreams come true. Oh no, there's nothing that I wouldn't do. Go to the ends of the earth for you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Rabbi Scott Glass. So, Scott, we're coming down to the last, 15 minutes of the show or so. And the way I close the show is with a question: how do you take care of yourself intellectually, emotionally, physically, throughout the day, throughout the week, the month, the year, and how do you know that you need to do it?
How do I know that I need to do it?
Yes. Whether or not you respond to that knowledge.
I just wake up in the morning and I realize I better do something.
Otherwise, it's not. You're not getting out of bed without some effort.
Really? I do go to the gym regularly. I have a trainer, and that is has become very important for me. If it wasn't obvious to anybody who's known me, this was not part of my life, very early on. I mean, this is, only in the last almost 20 years now. But, so that from a physical perspective, I tried to do that. So music is important to me. I don't read music. I have over the years tried every year to go to a festival, a choral festival. 5 days. It's 5 days. It's like summer camp for me. and it's a glorious experience. And unfortunately I didn't go last year and I'm not going to be able to go this year, but I do try to go because it is just, an infusion of spirit and a break from the norm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And a concentration on something that's really not my area of expertise. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I do that. I put a great deal of stock in the convention of keeping the seventh day holy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So even though people will joke with me and say, yeah, but you work. But when I'm not working, right, in quotation marks, I do make it my business to rest, mm-hmm, and to engage in leisure activities that are relaxing and not work related, mm-hmm, necessarily. So those are all things, I guess, that I try to do to take care of myself.
And when you were talking about the choral festival, mm-hmm. I was thinking of the saying, you know, when you sing, you pray twice. Also, when you sing mm-hmm. for more than 5 or 6 minutes at a time, it has the same effect as meditation on mm-hmm. your body and in terms of your blood chemistry and stuff. Right. And it's just a wonderful way to manage that. There's a saying among Protestants in rural communities that, you know, when the pastor comes to town, the first thing you've got to do is find the village atheist and make that one your best friend. because there's a certain amount of truth to it.
Well, I have to say, some of my best friends, yeah.
No, but what's really kind of funny is that there's always, even in Christianity, been a large percentage of people who are functionally atheists, but they find community there, and they really and that's what they hold, and they mm-hmm. just avoid conversations, too many deep conversations about God. But the reason I brought that up is that that's a way. How have you made friends here? Because it's hard as a clergy person to have friends. And they provide a lot of the emotional support. Or it could be hard.
You know, I don't know. I remember when we first came to Ithaca, somebody warned Sharon, my wife, about not becoming too friendly with anybody because they leave.
And that's a because that is
of the
a saying
because
here.
Of the transient yeah. right. nature right. of the community. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, the natural thing, I think, for clergy is to become friendly with members of your congregation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there have been some very wonderful members of our congregation who've been very close to us. And over the years, they've constituted a great support system for us and have meant a great deal to us. And I think we mean something to them as well.
And not just as an official rabbi or rabbi's wife.
No, well, beings. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, yeah. And in the community, I think we made friends like everybody else made friends. You had kids the same age and you know, your kids went to the same nursery school or you served on a committee or something like that. I also, and I think you know this, especially in my early years here, there were a number of members of the clergy who were really, really wonderful friends to me. You know, enriched our lives immeasurably and really stood by us in some very difficult times. And so all of those are ways that, you know, we became friends.
Right. And those clergy, you were the junior among them.
Yeah, that's right.
By many years.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's also a wonderful situation to be in if they're good-hearted people.
Yes. Right. And, you know, you draw a lot of strength and wisdom. Mm-hmm. From these people, and it was my great good fortune again.
So I want to get to where you're headed in terms of the next phase of your life a little bit, but I also want to ask, how have you taken care of yourself when your very identity and your community have been threatened?
I have told the story a number of times, and I think it's, you know, you don't often find yourself in that position, but when you find yourself in that position and you're fortunate enough to have wise and loving friends, they are who or what gives you the strength and courage to do what you need to do. And really, that's exactly what happened. When we felt most threatened, there were members of the clergy in the community who stood up for us and said, you know, okay, it's for us to take the lead, not you. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You need to trust us to do this and, you know, to take care of it. And they did. Mm-hmm.
And so friends are really, really, really important.
Oh, no question.
On all sorts of levels, yeah. And that's one of the things that I think. There's an interesting article in the Times yesterday about how the problem isn't our incivility; it's our absolute utter disdain for one another. and to look at each other with the capacity that we could be friends is a huge leap for a lot of people. And
right.
I think that's where the, to me, that's where the work is at this moment. When you extract yourself from Ithaca,
yes,
it's only 4 hours away from where you're going to be, but it's still 4 hours away, and friendships that are 4 hours away change substantially over time.
Indeed.
So how do you anticipate replanting yourself in Riverdale?
Well, first of all, both our daughters live...
family's a good thing.
Fairly close. Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going back to where we grew up, not so much in Riverdale, but the New York City area.
Right.
So our siblings are there, and Sharon's mother is there, and, you know, cousins and family. And family has always been very important to us. Yeah. But we're familiar with the neighbor, with the area where we're going to be, where we hope to be living, and familiar with the synagogue there. And we already know a number of people there. So I think, you know, we'll be in a different situation, but that's also good.
Right.
A change
right.
is also good.
Right. Right. And,
and I won't be a professional, which is a good thing.
Right.
Also a nice change. So
you will still be a rabbi.
Oh yes, I will still be a rabbi, but I won't be a pulpit rabbi yeah. and I won't, you know, I won't have those burdens, responsibilities. You know, privileges.
Right. And we began the show with your speaking of the intensity of four generations in a household at one time.
Yep.
And the blessing that was on your life. You're going to be walking into a situation where it will be three, and if you live long enough, four generations in the same general area.
Right.
And it's also, you know, your health has not been what you would have wanted it to be.
Right.
And being back in a place where you have these networks in place that you can give to and that can give to you, that's a major accomplishment in a move after you retire.
I think so.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Cool. So you wanted to close with a piece that is traditionally used to close worship.
So it is the last line of what's often a closing hymn in our services. The hymn is called Adon Olam, but the last line is Beyado Afkid Ruchi, and it talks about how it's a hymn to trust. This last line, Beyado Afkid Ruchi, in his hands I entrust my soul.
Wow. And
you'll hear, I mean, the English translation is there, so.
Scott, it has been wonderful to get to know you.
Well, thank you. It's been my pleasure, Eric.
Shall not fear, hold me in
my soul I give to thee. My spirit is in your care. Draw me near, thou shalt not fear. Hold me in your hand. Draw me near, thou shalt not fear. Adore.